Welcome to A Piece of My Mind, a project that uses storytelling and art to rediscover what connects us. I'm John Noltner, the founder and director of A Piece of My Mind, and I have the good luck to travel the country and the world photographing people to reveal the beauty and wisdom that's all around us, if we choose to see it. This new season is called Still Here, and for these stories, we traveled to coastal Louisiana. During our 9 days in the state, we heard a lot about disappearance. Not only are marshes and barrier islands vanishing, but so is black-owned farmland. So are the livelihoods of shrimpers and the tradition of eating Gulf seafood. So are local grocery stores, neighborhood music clubs, affordable houses. And yet, we met people who were planting their stakes in this marshy ground saying, "We're still here. We're not going away. This place is too precious to abandon." Their hard work and the work of others like them is key to the survival of the lower 48's most fragile coastline and a model for the rest of the country. Thanks for tuning in to listen to their stories. For this series, we're partnering with longtime friend and journalist Barry Yeoman. Based in North Carolina, Barry has lived and worked in Louisiana and has written extensively about the complexities of culture, environment, and economy along the state's coastline. It's his voice you'll hear leading the interviews.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, too.
So I'd like to start by asking you to introduce yourself and tell me where we're sitting right now.
My name is Rashida Ferdinand. I am working with Sankofa Community Development Corporation. We're based in the Lower Ninth Ward area of New Orleans, Louisiana. So we're sitting in our operating headquarters.
And if we had not met previously, which actually we only met this morning for the first time, what would be the first thing you would want me to know about you?
The first thing that comes to mind is that I'm on a journey, always in this space of growth, learning, and exploration to be a better human being.
Lovely. So we are in a place here in the Lower Ninth Ward that you have deep roots in. And I'm wondering if we could start by you telling me your story of growing up here.
Yeah, the story really centers around family and community. My parents were both raised in this neighborhood, and my father's mother actually was raised in this neighborhood as well. So there's some rooted history that I think just became a part of my identity being here in this neighborhood. But I just recall fun times with friends, fun times on our bicycles, being close to grandparents, being close to cousins, going to your little neighborhood sweet shops and corner stores. You know, those things that made it feel just comfortable, but it's what I knew. So wherever a child is raised is what you know. But those are those memories that come forth to me.
You said that you inherited an understanding of the place. And I'm wondering what stories you are hearing from your parents, from your grandparents about this place.
I hear stories of their experiences playing in nature, especially my father, his brothers, and their friends, and experiencing like the green space of this neighborhood, where crawfish lived in the gullies in front of the houses, or the canals, some of the streets that used to be canals, you know, referencing how you didn't have to lock your doors at night. And then you hear other folks tell you these stories, you know, how they may have shared and exchanged. And it wasn't a formal bartering system. It was just sharing things. If I have some fish and you have some dog food, you know, we just kind of have a communal approach to share resources. What it did for me was just give me a kind of a picture of what is possible, if it's real, and if it exists at one time, then it still could exist. I mean, the idea of living in a space that integrated family, community life with nature, or a space that felt safe and community was engaging and supporting each other. And it's kind of that lens that I want to approach the work that we're doing.
Then you leave. You go off to college, as many of us do, and you study ceramics.
I did. I studied ceramics at Howard University and then followed to continue doing this work at Syracuse University.
And when you got your MFA at Syracuse, had you come back here?
I came back to New Orleans immediately after Syracuse. I had plans to move to New York City. I love New York City. The energy, the opportunity that I thought it could afford me as an emerging, growing artist. But I wanted to also be in a warm environment, physically and culturally warm, being around blue, purple, yellow houses, being around my family. My grandmother was getting older. So it was a no-brainer. It was a place of safeness and security for me to come back home.
So I love that phrase, culturally warm, and I know what that means for me. What does the cultural warmth of New Orleans mean for you?
It's an unassuming kind of relationship you have with people. And I find there's always that interest in knowing who you are, who you're connected to, where you're from, how we're connected. And that's what it gets to, is how we may know each other, who we may know that knows each other. And it's the excitement of it. It's the wonder of knowing that you're connected, or you're related to this person, or you grew up here, or you went to school here. Maybe it's a small town, small city, familiarity, but it feels good.
In terms of your own work, your own sculpture, your own ceramic work, how did the natural environment of New Orleans impact the work you created?
I started to look at what's going on in the earth, and I found that there's layers of clay in our earth closer to the river, and that just fascinated me. I would go other places. I recall going to Georgia. It was on a college campus, and I found out that the red clay ground was so beautiful to me. It's like terracotta, which is my favorite. And I was digging the clay from that campus ground and brought some of my friends with me to dig that clay with me. And I did the same when I came here. So to me, I remember experiencing that kind of raw element of the material I love to work with, and appreciating that it's like layers of it right here, which I studied, you know, sediments of earth and where clay bodies come from, or parts of clay bodies. But to actually be able to pull it myself from the ground was kind of cool, because I'm in school academic environment, you're mixing things from bags and making it in a more processed way.
It feels almost like the difference between a chef who's sourcing the best ingredients from around the world and one who is working with the foods that they can acquire within 5 radio miles of their restaurant. That there's
correct.
Something elemental about,
yeah.
about creating something from the place where you live.
Correct.
So what year did you come back here to New Orleans?
2001.
So you're working in the arts for 4 years, and then it's 2005. As we've been talking to people here in South Louisiana, we haven't been particularly focusing on people's Katrina stories, but your Katrina story is so essential to the next step in your life that I'm wondering if you might share both your experience of the storm and your departure from New Orleans afterward.
I evacuated with my family. We thought we were coming home. We knew something was happening. We needed to leave, but we thought we would be coming back. When we saw on the news television. We weren't coming back home. We figured out where we would just be rooted. So I was in Atlanta for a few months. I would give myself maybe 6, 7, 8 months, but I wanted to do something else. I wasn't getting settled. I had a wonderful place to stay, you know, comfortable, clean, but I was a bed and a table in my room. I didn't have things anymore. Everything was still here, except I took some core papers with me. But I said, well, maybe this is an opportunity to start over for myself. I did go do a couple of residencies. I went actually to California, and it was a residency that I did with Jurassic Art Center, which was great. Able to get moving, turn back to creating some of these molded sculptures. So that's when I started that actual series of these eyes that I replicated, cast, sculpted and cast. I did do some exhibitions in Atlanta, which were nice, which were good. It got me engaged and moving forward with my creative process, but I still wanted to come home. And when I did return home and realized that I took these core papers with me that helped me get some art grants, call Road Home, take care of my business paperwork. That was something that was afforded to me. I had the paperwork. I could call these numbers and do this. So coming back home and seeing just the desolation, just how empty, and this was a shell of nothing, right, when I came back. But I knew there were people who were trying to return home. And then there were folks who were organizing as well to support redevelopment of their communities, including this area. And I wanted to be a part of that energy since I was okay. I was healthy. I had a space. My house flooded, but I had a place to live, and it was still there. And so I looked at what my privileges were. What were those things that allowed me to do what I could do? And then there were so many people who also were coming into this city doing service work, wanting to share, wanting to give. And so we were all working together. And for me, the transition became moving from pot sculpture making to looking at the community itself as something we could recreate. And I worked with stakeholders, meaning people who were from the neighborhood or who still lived in the neighborhood, whether they moved away or still lived in the neighborhood. There was a vision and a passion for seeing things that could be rebuilt here. And I started to organize with those folks. We met on my porch, we met in my living room, and we started to plan it out, you know, plan out what we wanted to see happen. And we started with a smaller community marketplace, a monthly community fun, collaborative community gathering space. And there were a few of those that were happening around the city as well. There was one in Ferret. There was one in Lakeview area. We got some small seed money as we just started to envision this, but it was primarily a volunteer initiative. It was a volunteer initiative, I would say. We all were just working together. But I found that as I did this work, there was so much more that needed to be done. There was a request for fresh food. Okay, we have one farmer. Let's get more farmers. There's a need for health education. If a child is telling me this sweet potato only grows in a can and it's bright orange, no, that's a sweet potato. This weird looking vegetable right here is really a sweet potato. It's like understanding that there's just more work we need to do around health education and awareness, trying to meet people where they are, and this process of working integrally with community stakeholders was the model that we followed, and just started to just develop more projects and initiatives that connected to this concept of rebuilding and revitalizing.
As we were driving over here, we're working with several interns, two of whom are here in this room right now, and one asked me for kind of a primer on the Lower Ninth Ward. And what I realized was that if you were a 21-year-old, Katrina happened when you were a toddler. So what many of us know about the Lower Ninth Ward, either because in your case, it was home. In many of our cases, because we were glued to the news, that's increasingly not a shared base of knowledge because it's now 20 years ago. Could you help us understand the unique situation that the Lower Ninth Ward was in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina?
You know, unique in a way that we are separated from the rest of the city by this canal, and we had the highest rate of flooding and loss. The devastation just wiped out 80% of the neighborhood. So there are multiple challenges in returning to your space, accessibility to get there, then returning to something, what do you have? Because the infrastructure was totally decimated. So even if there was opportunity to get a trailer, you have to get it hooked up, you have to get the electricity, plumbing, those things. We also had those issues with the resources that were supposed to be allowed for us to be built were based on your appraised value of your home, but not on the costs to actually restore it. So we got very little to nothing. Whereas if I lived in another part of the city, I probably would have gotten three times as much. Those things, we just kind of just keep plugging along because you have only time to deal with a few issues. And if this is what you're told, you're like, okay, I guess this is the rule. This is what's been created. So we're in a unique position of not having any power on of what we could get or getting the things that we really needed to rebuild.
So in that crucible, you start having conversations with neighbors, with other community leaders. You make the first steps in terms of a market. Mm-hmm. How does that start to set the wheels in motion for the creation of Sankofa?
I think the market helped us understand what's really possible and what's needed and who's there to support us. It becomes an inspiration. And then when you're working with people. So the marketplace itself, it was a monthly event. Seeing folks who reconnected, sometimes hadn't seen each other since they evacuated. Once again, there were a number of organizations and people who've been doing active work before the Hurricane Katrina disaster who we were organizing with. There were a lot of faith-based groups that we were organizing with, but it was important just to see what the need was and connect with a diverse amount of people to address that need. That was the inspiration. That's what made it possible to continue to grow.
So what year had the organization officially started?
2008.
In those 17 years, y'all have done a lot of things. And I want to ask you about the place that we went to when we landed in New Orleans last week. The first place we stopped was at the Wetlands Park, which is just beautiful. And it's so unexpected. You're driving along this pretty disinvested part of the neighborhood, and then you just come to this jewel, this beautiful wetlands, and there were egrets, and there was birdsong, and there was a boardwalk, and there were these beautiful trees. For me, knowing that this was not just beauty, this was really about the safety of the neighborhood and about the protection of the neighborhood from future storms. I was hoping you could tell me about the vision that created the idea of the park and then how you made it happen.
So the vision came from, once again, people who, you know, I was working with and organizing with one of our partnering friends, Steve Ringo, had a packet of information on how the bayou could be an economic development resource to support revitalization of this neighborhood. And he was pretty committed to that and shared this around and asked me, why don't we do this? because that could be, it could be big. People come here for this. People come here for water experiences, for land, for nature-based experiences. There also was another partner, friend, who was aware of a green infrastructure grant. And she told me, this is available to apply for. Let's do this. Mary Fontenot, she said, hey, we need to do something. We need to own something. This is important. These are public places we need to develop. So it kept coming, you know. And I wasn't excited about doing something else because we really did have our hands full. Our capacity was up to limits. But I believed in what they believed in because they said we can do it. I believed that. And I started to explore what that could look like. I met Professor Emeritus John Day. We started working on the project together. He said, I'm all in. So we've been working together, his team, and then another colleague of his, Dr. Gary Schaefer, to build the park out.
I'm wondering if you could help me imagine what that wetlands looked like before it became a park.
So that area was filled in with dirt, and some other parts of it were filled in with illegally dumped debris, which we've had to remove tens of thousands cubic yards of it. So that's what it looked like. It was full of invasives. We had to walk the grounds, Dr. John Day and Dr. Gary Schaefer and I. We walked the grounds with machete and moved through the thickness of the vegetation. Wow. It wasn't a healthy vegetated forest. But what we all had together was what we're saying is that vision of seeing what this place could be. And they already knew what we could do because they've been doing this off the back of their hand in other places. But we talked about different ways of planning it out, laying out the space, what a retention pond would do. And I apply for the funding. I have a 501c3. I have, you know, that area of capacity is important. Apply for the funding. Didn't get it the first time, applied again, and just was committed to seeing this happen. And it's been a long haul. It's been a lot of convincing and navigating through different systems to get the legal work, to get the resources needed to develop it. But those layers of team members make it happen.
So now it's a beautiful place with cypress trees and tupelo trees and bird life, but it's more than aesthetic. What does having a healthy wetland do to protect this neighborhood?
So we've always had healthy wetlands until this shift in how engineering was going to take place decimated the wetlands. There was still, I'm saying, during my father's upbringing, his years, his formative years, he experienced being in healthy wetlands, he and his friends, going into this Bayou Bienvenue wetland triangle area where there were amazing cypress trees, you know, abundant and alive and thriving. As this Mississippi River Gulf outlet destroyed that area, the saltwater intrusion destroyed them, it's created this open space, which you find throughout coastal southeastern Louisiana. We see this space as an example, very small, big for us because we're, you know, walking through it, but it's small, but it's a really significant example of how nature just returns back to its rightful space. And we just allow it to breathe. The water makes a big difference in what's invited to live in this area. That's what's helped create these bird habitats, the riparian buffer where the little organisms, the macroinvertebrates, the smaller organisms that start to feed that eco chain are significant. Having the space of this small, healthy wetland space is really returning into what it once was, but also allows us to see what could be and understand what could be and be an opportunity for young folks who come for our STEM education or their workforce development programs to be invested in building and restoring more spaces like this.
When you think of the other work Sankofa has done over the last 17 years, what are the projects that you're most proud of that you look at and you say, yes, this is a better neighborhood because of our work?
For sure, the Sankofa Wetland Park is the one, because it's such a normal, it's a regular area. It's just, when I say regular, normal area, it's just the earth being the earth. It shows how easy it is to just appreciate, you know, what's going on with our geological systems, with our water, groundwater systems, how the animals, the flora and the fauna both live, and how symbiotic it is. So that's by far my favorite. I do love that we have this Sankofa Fresh Start Market, this beautiful space that's clean, that has an abundance of fresh food, and it's used and it's appreciated. And it's something we haven't had in a long time, and asking for a food space and a grocery store and these. And okay, nobody's bringing it, so we decided we're going to make it happen and bring it. And it works.
When we were here on our first day again, John and I stopped at the wetlands and stopped at the community gardens and then stopped at the market and was looking at those camellia beans and thinking, those look mighty good. And oh, those plus a couple of green peppers and those beautiful red onions and oh, the celery. And we had a really nice meal the next night.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Made almost entirely from stuff that we bought at the market. So thank you for the vision that led to it. And this morning we took some photos in a beautiful garden. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that area where we took photos just a few months ago was remarkably blighted. And we've cut the grass and cut the trees down. We've done that multiple times and tried to purchase the land, and we didn't own the land, and it's not our property. There's only so much you can do. But the city, some program within the city that's transitioning blighted properties into the hands of people who could maintain them, who live adjacent or work adjacent to them, offered it to us to restore, maintain it, and then we could purchase it before it starts to bid out on the auction. So, you know, it was going to be an oak reform, but the ground testing just revealed a high level of lead. So sunflowers, still beautiful, pollinators are very important to us. It's a part of a project we're doing with USDA and RCS. It's a part of a need and creating new spaces for pollinators to grow and the pollinating insects and animals to also feed off of and support. And so that's what that was our initial pilot for this pollinator garden. And we're expanding it to some parcels that we also own on Tennessee Street to create this kind of, you know, sunflower flower form. There'll also be a revenue generating space eventually, a U-pick form. We'll have a pumpkin patch there in a few months. And next to it is a community garden that we've been managing, leading that project since 2010. And we acquired that land from our local redevelopment authority. We purchased it from the redevelopment authority. And there's land that was once owned by people in the neighborhood. They didn't return back home and sold it to another program. It got transitioned to this redevelopment authority, and then we purchased it. So some of these properties, many of these properties used to have homes on them, and they're green space, and sometimes they're invasive, full of invasive and blighted green space, which we cleared out to build the sunflower farm.
That's lovely. 20 years ago, the eyes of the nation were on this little patch of land right here, this little cut-off neighborhood in New Orleans that was seeing the impact of not just increasingly powerful storms, but also the damage caused by human infrastructure, and carved into the brains of anyone who was paying attention in 2005. 20 years later, Where is the Lower Ninth Ward? Where has it blossomed? Where has it grown? Where does it still need some help?
I would start with the blossoming. The blossoming are the few folks who are here who chose to come home to the neighborhood, are people who also decided to move into the neighborhood and start living here after the Katrina disaster. And I think the blossoming is folks who love this space and bring their, I'm going to say their humanity, their loving kindness to caring about it enough to see it grow and thrive. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. There's a lot of just intentional, authentic, caring, planning work and implementation work. It requires investment of resources. We know that those resources are here. They've been invested in so many different places and ways, and there's investment that's needed. Money were allocated to this space and were diverted into other areas of the city. There needs to be a belief and a care that this place has worth and value. And we need to address those systems that cause the crown to sink here. We're not just below sea level. There's a responsibility that we have as human beings on how we engineer our systems to create this ground's level of depth. The groundwater level is drained and pumped out. It causes the soil to shrink. It causes the ground to sink. The systems that we consider to be viable engineering systems, we're doing them because the other person did them before us and the other person did them before us. But why did they start doing it this way? We need to start to rethink what we consider to be a healthy infrastructure system. So there's opportunities for looking at these models for green infrastructure, whether it's how you build houses and buildings, how you use drainage spaces, where water goes, how we address these issues of climate change and be responsible for it. Be responsible people, be responsible stewards of our land. So there's some opportunities there, a lot of opportunities there, and we're hoping to be a catalyst for that movement.
You're, of course, becoming a catalyst at a time when there are forces that are not exactly helping you, where we see federal funding slashed, where we see efforts to revitalize communities deprioritized. Amidst this national landscape, what impels you forward and what gives you hope?
A friend of mine she sent me this note it was about turtles, and a turtle just takes its time and keeps moving through the ocean, and it's moving slowly, but it's going somewhere and it ends up where it has to go. It just takes its time and keeps moving. And it compels me that we all exist and we have a right to exist. And there's nobody who can stop the true, you know, life that we're supposed to have from happening. And it is interesting. I try to understand, why do people do these things they're doing? What is the catch? What are they getting out of it? What's their stimulant? And I'm going to believe that we can prevail by being honest and authentic and positive and in speaking the truth. So, you know, I've been told by many of my elders, we've seen this before. We've seen worse before. And I mean, people who've lived a long time can see that cycle because it's present to some of us right now. And we didn't know that. It is scary, but I'm not afraid, because I think there's enough folks in a community of goodness, in care and loving kindness, that in intelligence, just basic intelligence, that we still do this work that we're doing. I don't think we should just allow a few monsters to scare us out of our beautiful light.
I'm going to carry those words with me. My God, thank you. This feels like a good stopping point, but before we do, is there any question that you wish I'd asked you that I haven't asked you?
I think you've asked a lot. I think I feel okay. Yeah.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Thank you too. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Still Here, a series produced by A Piece of My Mind. I'm John Noltner, the founder and director of A Piece of My Mind. Be sure to visit our website, listed in the episode notes, to see photos and video from this story. This series is produced with interview help from journalist Barry Yeoman, editing help from summer interns Kate West, Sawyer Garrison, and Caitlin Emai, and audio production by Rosick Seifela.